EJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and joining me today is my co-host, Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm going to be talking tonight a little bit about a particular class that I'm in this semester. I am in a philosophy of mind class, so I've been exploring, well, the philosophy of mind. It's particularly from the perspective of contemporary philosophy, so it's been explored, and especially contemporary issues. So we're going to be looking into things like artificial intelligence and consciousness and machines and whatnot very soon. The course has a pretty solid foundation in the history of the philosophy of mind. I mean, there's no... The branch of philosophy, the philosophy of mind, is actually quite recent. People have always been exploring it, but it's never been a distinguished part of philosophy until pretty recently, especially as we have encountered machines that could potentially be intelligent and whatnot. But in any case, the historical review has been interesting, but it's also been a bit, I don't want to say confusing, maybe that's the wrong word for it. It's not that it's been confusing, but there have been some things in the class that have, I would say, troubled me. Now, maybe that's to be expected. It's a philosophy class. You're essentially dealing with philosophical problems. Problems are going to constitute the class. Nothing is going to be, there will be clear-cut distinctions and whatnot, but in any case, there's something particular about the history of the philosophy of mind that I've encountered that doesn't seem to be acknowledged, or if it is acknowledged, it doesn't seem to be addressed by the sort of canonical narrative in the philosophy of mind that we encounter, and that is a particular problem with monism that I have seen. So I suppose it would be worth putting down a small kind of narrative of the philosophy of mind, just to kind of contextualize the listener how monism, what monism is, how monism arises in the philosophy of mind, and what I'm noticing it doing in the philosophy of mind, and some of the problems that I'm seeing it sort of have. The philosophy of mind and its central problem is the mind-body interaction problem, right? We have this idea of having a mind, historically it would have been referred to as a soul, and its relationship to the body, whatever that means, our human body, and the various states that our bodies can be in and whatnot, and our what was called affections. But That distinction has precedence in ancient and medieval philosophy, but the problem that we see it take, or the form that we see the problem of mind-body interaction, it really gets its, the form that we have it now starts with René Descartes, right? And the distinction he draws between mind and body as distinct metaphysical substances. So he draws a metaphysical distinction between an extended substance that is body and a non-extended substance that is thought. Now, this was noticed, the irreconcilable differences between these two substances were noticed pretty early on. And how it is that two things that are categorically distinct are able to interact. Descartes doesn't seem to give a satisfactory answer. I've looked over his reply to Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia quite thoroughly, and I don't think that his attempt to solve the problem of how the two interact works. It's more or less a cop out, but that's a I mean, the way he tries to solve the problem of a non-extended substance interacting with an extended substance is to say that there is a sort of primitive union between the two that explains the apparent union of them in our senses. But for reasons that would be beyond this show, it doesn't work. In any case, so we have this position of having two substances. So we have body on the one hand and mind on the other. This is the metaphysical position of substance dualism, right? That there are ultimately two real substances. At rock bottom, reality is body and mind. Now, in the next step of this story in the philosophy of mind comes the monistic attempts to reconcile, or not so much reconcile as makes a coherent metaphysical position arise, because dualism in this way, as it's formulated by Descartes, doesn't work, right? If there is this interaction, this apparent interaction between mind and body, if we have people who really have minds, then a dualistic metaphysics isn't going to make sense. So the reaction to dualism is for people to begin positing monistic metaphysical system or metaphysical positions. Monism being that ultimately reality is one substance. And the two schools of monism that arise in the philosophy of mind are materialism and idealism. And they have people on either sides, but in the class that I'm taking, each is kind of exemplified by one particular thinker. Materialism is represented by Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes. I think we've talked about Thomas Hobbes before on the show. And Berkeley, who exemplified idealism. So, and each of these ultimately take one side of the dualistic metaphysics of Descartes and say, well, really, reality is one or the other. You can explain the other. Well, you can explain one of them in terms of the other. So for Hobbes, he has an idea of the mind as the product of motion. Since he's a materialist, everything is matter, and the mind is a consequence of various kinds of motion that happens. So we have sense organs, and motion is communicated to them, you know, through sound or light or heat or anything like that. He wouldn't have had a neurology for this, but he did kind of anticipate interior motions. So we have the motions go into us, and then those motions interact with the other motions in our body, and those are the mind, right? Now, with idealism, the system is essentially reversed. You can explain matter in terms of the substance of thought. So everything simply is a thought, because you wouldn't have had any idea of matter if it wasn't a thought. You encounter these things all through thoughts, and you perceive these thoughts, and that's what gives them their existence. Now, in the next step of the story, ultimately you have this clash of ideal or materialism and idealism. Materialism wins. Going forward into the 20th century, idealism does get a showing in German idealism, but Kant is, and Immanuel Kant being the kind of starting off point of all of this, but I think of Kant more as a synthesizer than an idealist, just considering that he does have an external world. It's all filtered through categories of the understanding, but there really is a world that we are seeing. But in any case, because it's an English-speaking philosophy of mind class, we have to go with materialism, and we have to go on to explain behaviorism and functionalism and whatnot. Now, there seems to... at each step in the kind of history of materialist ideas of the philosophy of mind, there's always this critique that gets made of a materialist position, right? So we see it immediately with Thomas Hobbes and his materialism, that you have motions and you have matter, right? And the mind is the consequence of these motions. So light goes into your eyes, and that motion communicated from the eye to the mind or to the brain is sight. That is the phenomenon of sight. But then there's always this question of, okay, sure, that makes total sense. That's a, you can do physics with that. That makes complete sense. But there's always this question of, okay, well, what happened to the thing I saw, right? What happened to the felt qualities of the thing that I'm seeing? So maybe I'm looking at a glass of water. If all of that is just motion, how does that explain the phenomenon that I am seeing, a transparent liquid in a transparent glass, or maybe I'm looking at something opaque? How do these qualities emerge from strictly material, physical kind of properties, I suppose? And later on, when you get to behaviorism, behaviorists or strict behaviorists are quite willing to say, okay, those qualities that you see or those qualities that you are thinking of, maybe they're really there, but we're not really interested in talking about them, or we can't talk about them scientifically, so we're not really interested in talking about them. We can explain things in terms of stimuli and response, in terms of an organism in relation to its environment. And that really is the substance of the philosophy of mind, is talking about behavior, observable things, right? But then in reply to this, the philosophy of mind, the storyteller of the philosophy of mind says, okay, well, that almost just, like, we actually want to be able to talk about these qualities. Why have the behaviorists made this move? It's like asking someone to talk about something, but then they say, okay, well, in order to talk about that, I'm going to talk about something completely unrelated. Well, you're just not talking about the thing that we want to talk about. The example that I thought up of was the idea of a person who very early on in their life, they realize they love flowers, right? And they love all of the associations and all of the qualitative things about flowers. They love flower arrangements. They love flowers and culture and cultural events related to flowers. I don't know. They just have an obsession with flowers. And obviously it's their life's calling. So they go to university to study flowers, and they're learning, you know, biology. Maybe if they're lucky, they're taking an English class and reading a book that has flowers in it. But more or less, they're just learning biology and botany in order to become a florist and a biologist of flowers. But there's never really addressed or never really given an opportunity to talk about those qualities of flowers. I mean, if they want to write poetry or study poetry of flowers, that's sure. But that's not really considered by the institutions where one goes to seriously study flowers. That's not really considered a respectable way to study flowers. If you're serious about studying flowers, you have to go study them biologically. But that completely strips it of the qualitative, experiential aspect of flowers that made this person want to go study flowers. I'm comparing this to the way that behaviorists study or say that the mind ought to be studied. We were drawn to studying the mind because it had all of these colorful and interesting things about it. But the moment we start taking our psychology classes and we start learning about stimuli and response, it's like, wait, hold on a second. This is not what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about something more vague, but that's why I came to university to study it, so I could learn how to talk about it. And now you're just telling me that can't be done. I'm sorry. We have to just study something that's observable. And that might be, I think that that's one good approach for something, but I don't know if it's a good approach for studying the mind, or at least the mind in this way that people want to. It sort of misses the point, as it were. But that's the point, is there seems to be something about taking materialism seriously that misses the point, right? So at each step in studying the philosophy of mind and going through materialist theories, there's always something missing, right? There is always this cleft drawn between what we can really talk about theoretically, but isn't really what we want to be talking about, and the stuff that we really do want to be talking about, these qualities, how they are experienced, but we can't talk about them. They're kind of they're behind a conceptual wall. It's impossible to talk about these things. Now, so this is where my kind of trouble with materialism as it stands lies, and it's in this conceptual impossibility to talk about what we want to be able to talk about when we are doing materialism, right? When we are, and this is the important point for me, it's that apparently materialism is a monism. So if it's a monism, it should explain everything. It's a theory of, it's a metaphysical position that says all things are this one thing. You can explain everything in terms of this one principle of reality, matter or materialism. And yet there seems to be something cut off from being explainable in terms of this monistic metaphysical position, and that's mind. It's precisely the thing we want to be talking about. So my initial kind of diagnosis of this problem is to say that materialism, as it's conceived in the philosophy of mind, is not actually a monistic theory. I want to call it a pseudo-monism. It doesn't, if there is something that can't be explained in terms of matter, or can't intelligibly be talked about in terms of matter, then it's not a theory that explains reality, because our minds are a part of reality, and that's why I'm calling it a pseudomonism. I'm also calling it a pseudomonism because I think that it essentially has roots in dualism. Now, this is why it was really important to explain the story of how these theories came about, where in the beginning, when the mind-body problem was inaugurated by Descartes, it was inaugurated by a dualistic metaphysics. And then what happened was people took sides in the Descartes war. And some people said, I'm a materialist. And some people said, I'm an idealist. Ultimately, the taking sides of one of these dualistic positions was kind of the, how do we want, we would, I guess we might say, like, the repression of dualism. We never left a dualistic frame of mind by adopting a materialist position or an idealist position. So in a certain way, you can have a theoretical commitment to monism. You can say, I'm a materialist. But that commitment arises from a dualistic problem. You still operate under dualistic premises, even though you have a monistic theory. And that's why I'm saying that since these metaphysical positions of monism don't account for all of reality, they are pseudo-monisms.
You are describing in your own way, in your own words, the big problem in the philosophy of mind, which is sort of a paradox. If you assert dualism, that there are two substances, then you run into the interaction problem, as you eloquently articulated.
Mm-hmm.
Descartes tried to solve it with some of the claim, you know, about the pineal gland, which turned out to be, debunked as some sort of interface between the material and the immaterial in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
So the seemingly intractable problem of interaction arises if you assert two substances, mind and body, as being distinct substances.
Yeah.
But where we run into real trouble is there's a similar, seemingly intractable problem with materialist or materialist monism, which is that how do you explain qualia? How do you explain, emotions and feelings and experiences? Qualitative intentionality, qualitative aspects of the human experience. How do you explain that if you're asserting that all there is just matter? How does qualia arise out of matter?
Yeah.
And that is also something you articulated. But I think that you're making an error, or at least from my point of view, it's an error to conflate materialism in general, or materialist monism in general, with one iteration or maybe a few iterations of materialism, which deny the existence of qualia or assert that you can't really talk about them. You can't know anything about them. They can't be subjects of inquiry or knowledge because they're unobservable.
Mm-hmm.
There are some genres of materialism which hold those assertions to be true, perhaps eliminative materialism.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not, hasn't really gained much traction in popularity. I think the iterations of materialism that have become predominant, such as functionalism in particular,
mm-hmm.
do not deny qualia. And so I think I think it's a mistake to conflate materialism with a denial of intentionality and qualia and experiences which are not simply a description of matter interacting with other matter or matter in motion. So I think that's important to say that we can't dismiss materialism simply by saying, well, it doesn't acknowledge qualitative experiences, because that's not true. There are, depending on which particular theory one subscribes to, but which materialist theory, which monistic theory, monistic materialist mm-hmm. theory, there are explanations for qualia. And it's a point of contention, I know. I mean, Thomas Nagel in particular argued against materialism in a similar way that you have been arguing against materialism, which is that materialist theories don't seem to account for qualitative mind states. And just to give, you know, some acknowledgement to that claim, and what, you know, a perfect example would be music. So you can look at a sheet of paper where the musical notes are written on the paper, and you could understand the mechanics of the music.
Mm-hmm.
You could even measure the sounds, right? The wavelengths of the sounds that were coming out of a musical instrument.
Yeah.
So you could describe the mechanics and the tempo and the volume and all of these things you could describe in a physical sense, but that completely fails to capture the experience a person has when listening to the music.
Yeah.
Which cannot be described in that same physical way. And the same holds true for many things, right? For the beauty of a sunset, or many qualitative experiences, perhaps all qualitative experiences seem to have, and Nagel pointed this out, something more to them than simply their physical or biological descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
But that still doesn't imply denial of materialism. So I just to forgive you one theory, it's also not the most popular theory. Perhaps functionalism is the most prevalent, but I like a theory that's been promoted by Donald Davidson, which talks about how our descriptions of our qualitative experiences are actual descriptions of our qualitative experiences, and we're actually having those qualitative experiences. However, they are descriptions of events which are identical to physical events in our brains. So a physical event happens in the brain, and that physical event can be described in multiple ways.
Yeah.
So let's say a neuroscientist who was studying the subject's brain, the patient's brain, might describe those physical movements or the physical brain state in whatever terms the neuroscientist would describe them.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be physical things happening in the brain that could be described in a physical, biological, neurological way. But according to Davidson's theory, if the patient was also saying at the time, I'm feeling fear, or I'm feeling pain in my right leg, or I'm feeling excited, those are just alternate descriptions of those same physical events. So there's no denial that the person, that the patient, that the subject is having those qualitative experiences. It's just that the language used to describe the qualitative experiences is an alternate language to what the neuroscientist would be using to describe the physical events that are happening in the brain. So that's one way to to cross that bridge, to reconcile how